The Cue Bill Doggett. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to the 143rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 142 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13.com. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. And Westchester Guardian is W-E-S-T-C-H-E-S-T-E-R-G-U-A-R-D-I-A-N. It includes the 203rd column in the Creative Disruption series. But I hope to read the column, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. The previous radio show, the recordings for all 142 are available at my web home, and also a free daily newspaper that's a curation of news articles and columns from around the country and the world. But the real focus on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead, in addition to what one might expect in the world of politics, sports, books, the environment, and entertainment. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day. Once again, that's johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings to live, or as most do, to listen later from the recordings archived. Next week, my guest will be Alan Brode, CEO, techmarketing.com, and iBreakfast. And to this show, the 143rd the series, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until the end of my interview with my guests. My guest tonight is Mary Roach, author of 7 nonfiction works, including the just-published Grunt, The Cure Science of Humans at War. In addition to Mary's appearance on this show tonight, she'll be at Town Hall Seattle in Seattle, Washington this Wednesday, June 15th at 7:30 p.m. Doors open to 6:30 p.m. The entry price is $31.95, and the price admits two and includes a copy of Grunt. For information, call 206-652-4255. That's, once again, 206-652-4255, or point your browser to https://townhallseattle.org, all one word, townhallseattle.org. The book and her writing in general has received both praise and much attention in the press. Just this weekend, she had been the subject of separate interviews in both the Seattle Times and the New York Times Book Review. And now she's here to discuss her life and writing on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Hanover, New Hampshire, and just across the Connecticut River in Norwich, Vermont, basically the same area. My dad taught at Dartmouth, and my mom was a secretary there. They met there and fairly late in their life. My dad was 65 when I came along. Anyway, I grew up in Vermont and New Hampshire.
You mentioned that in your bios, your father's age, and in the Times interview today, you mentioned that he was retired by the time you were born, and the public library was the kind of a daycare center for you. It sounds as though you were brought up in an atmosphere that cherished reading. Is this accurate?
Yeah, very much so. My father, because he was retired, he made great use of the public library, the Howe Library it was called, and he'd find him over in the mystery and true crime and biography sections, and he would park me in the children's section because my mom was working. He was retired, and so I spent a lot of time, in the library as a kid.
What did he teach to Dartmouth?
He taught speech. It was interesting. He was born in England, in Widnes, which is a working-class factory town. He came over on the Lusitania when he was 19 and kind of remade himself, including his accent. He dropped his heavy kind of Midlands accent and developed kind of I have recordings of him. He sounds kind of like the actors in the 1940s with a kind of a unplaceable but posh accent, but not British, not American, just kind of a movie accent. So he had a little of that. So he taught speech, as he was obviously quite good at manipulating his own speech. He also worked in theater. He managed the theater of the Dartmouth Players, and he did set direction. He did all the publicity for the plays. He was quite an accomplished caricaturist, artist, silkscreener, photographer. None of these skills I inherited.
Speaking of skills, when did you first see yourself as becoming a writer?
Well, I graduated without any real direction. I was a liberal arts major, and I just thought, oh, somebody will hire me, I'm sure. And, of course, it was 1981 in the midst of a recession, and I didn't get anywhere. I started freelance copy editing, and proofreading was the first jobs that I had. And I just at a certain point realized some of the stuff I was copy editing was such a mess that it might be easier, that writing things in the first place might be more pleasurable than cleaning them up after someone else has written them. So I set about doing that. But I didn't come to writing with a great passion or a dream of being a writer. It just seemed to be something that was more appealing than being a copy editor freelance.
You mentioned you were a liberal arts major in college. Where did you go to college?
I went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
A couple of months ago, I had Pagan Kennedy, another author of nonfiction, on the show, and
yeah.
the Wesleyan graduate. And I asked her if she ran a course, Kit Reed, in the course of her study. Did you?
I didn't take a class with Kit Reed, but he was well known. I mean, he taught film, and he was quite popular and beloved there. And I just never did take a class from him. And Pagan Kennedy, I believe I didn't know she went to Wesleyan. I remember reviewing one of her wonderful books somewhere down the line.
Kit Reed was the favorite of an old acquaintance, John Perry Barlow, ex-Grateful Dead lyricist and co-founder of Electronic Frontier Foundation, who must have preceded you at Wesleyan. He refers to Kit as one of his heroes. Well, had you written for your high school paper or for college publication at all?
I don't think that Hanover High School had a newspaper, and I did not write. Wesleyan had a paper called The Argus, and I never wrote for The Argus. And I tried to get into a creative writing program course taught by Annie Dillard, I think.
A terrific writer.
Yes, she wrote Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek, right?
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. Yes, she taught there, and I had submitted a piece of writing to get into this my senior year, and I didn't get in, and that's the extent of my writing education.
After graduation, you moved to the West Coast. After growing up in the Northeast, what brought you there rather than staying east?
Well, I had no job possibilities lined up, and I didn't know anyone in New York City upon whose couch I could sleep. So I knew I wanted to be either in New York or somewhere like that. I wanted to get out of the small town milieu. And so I had a friend who was going to Berkeley for the summer, and we three of us got a drive-away car. I don't know if they still have those now. Some poor unsuspecting soul turns his or her automobile over to a bunch of college graduates, and they drive it across the country for free, paying only for gas. So that's what we did. And I stayed in Berkeley my first summer. One of the fraternities rent out rooms over the summer, empty frat rooms for very, very cheap. And that's where I stayed. And I got a temp job. I think it was the first job I had before the copy editing, the illustrious copy editing career. So it was just, you know, I had a friend who talked about San Francisco as this beautiful place with hills and ocean and some magical thing called dim sum, where people would roll carts around with this exotic food and you'd point at something and they'd put it on your table. And I thought, I need to see this magical city with hills. And that's what I did. And I stayed.
You mentioned you began as a freelance copy editor, and I know they also did some public relations work, but in 1986, you began to write freelance pieces for major newspapers and magazines. Tell us about that progression, how you started and how you...
I landed a job in the public affairs office of the San Francisco Zoological Society, and I got that job by first volunteering, just saying I'll volunteer to write just to get my foot in the door there. And then eventually they hired me half time, and that was a fun job. It was being on the grounds of the zoo, working in a trailer by Gorilla World. It was fun. It was a nice way to ease my way into writing, because I had the job part time, and then I could write articles the rest of the time. So that went on for about a year, maybe a year and a half, and then the public affairs job became a full-time job, and they offered it to me as full-time, and I didn't want to take it full-time. I was enjoying the freelance writing, so I made that frightening move to full-time freelancer, unfortunately, I had pretty low rent at the time.
I know that you wrote for the Chronicle, and you also wrote for the New York Times, and for... The Wired magazine. How did you move up the line like that?
What happens frequently with freelance writing is that you work with an editor and you establish a relationship with this editor, and then they get moved up from assistant editor to senior editor, and they, you know, managing editor. They make their way from one magazine to the next, and often take you along with them. So that happened. Editors that I worked with at the San Francisco Chronicle Examiner, the Sunday magazine, they went to other magazines, and that was my entree there. So that's tended to be what happened in those first years.
It's mentioned in your bio that in 1996 you became involved with the San Francisco-based project and community of working writers, The Grotto, which you contribute to, giving you the impetus to begin your book writing career. How did that all go down?
The San Francisco Writers Grotto, which still exists today, though I'm no longer there. A group of us every year. The background is that I've been writing magazine pieces for a dozen or more years, and never had come up with a book idea. And every year, a number of us would go. Toward the end of the year, every year at the beginning of the year, we would make predictions. By the end of the year, and for the people in the grotto, there were three of us, we'd go out and we'd make predictions about people's careers or personal lives, and then we'd get together the following year and see what had transpired. And someone made a prediction for me that by the end of the following year, I would have a book contract. So around about October, I realized I needed to get on this, because otherwise I'd have the humiliation of hearing someone say, "Merci, Mary, book contract." No. So I just decided to do it, because it's, you know, book contract, you're writing something on spec, you're not being paid. It's very easy to keep thinking, I'll do it next month. You never have a deadline. It's something you need to kind of light the fire under your own butt. So, but this, knowing that we'd be getting together and on the New Year's to go over the list of predictions. That's what kind of that was the impetus to really crack down and do it.
How did you happen to choose the subject of your first book? At first blush, the title "Stiff: The Curious the Lives of Human Cadavers" sounds rather macabre.
Yes, that was. It came about as a result of a column I'd been writing for the online magazine Salon.com, and I was having a conversation with an agent had contacted me based on that column. Salon.com was, I mean, it's still around today, but it's not as it doesn't have the same kind of buzz that it did when it first began. It was one of the first online magazines, and so agents would pay attention to it. And somebody contacted me and said, "Have you thought about a book?" And we went back and forth, and he said, "Well, which columns of yours have the highest hit count? How many people have, you know, clicked on it?" And a couple of columns that had to do with cadaver research, one about how you calibrate a crash test dummy using cadavers, and another one, well, it doesn't matter. But anyway, I had a couple of columns that had a high hit rate, and he suggested just writing a quick two-page treatment and then a quick proposal, and you know he had a lot more faith in the idea than I did. I thought that this seemed like an idea that was far too macabre or peculiar. You know, hard to imagine somebody looking at a table of new releases in a bookstore and pointing to my book and saying, "Oh yeah, this book about cadavers, that's what I'm going to buy." So, but he had confidence in it, and he was right. There were four or five publishing houses bidding on it, and away I went.
Well, the book's been highly praised and has since been translated into 17 languages. For your next book, you move from death to the next possible state, with Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. Please tell us about that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, Spook was a book that grew out of a chapter in Stiff that had to do with efforts centuries ago. Philosophers and anatomists would examine the human body kind of poking around, because no one knew what everything was and what the different parts did, and there was an attempt to locate the soul, like maybe it's this thing, maybe it's this little item inside the brain, maybe it's the pancreas, because all that real estate hadn't really been figured out. And I thought that was interesting, in that someone was applying hard science to something, the afterlife and the soul, and that something that's usually in the realm of religion. So I thought it would be interesting to look at, over the years, how science and scientific method have been applied to issues like the afterlife and the spirit. So that was that book. That's what that one was about. It wasn't really a personal quest. I knew that Mary Roach, with her BA in psychology, was not likely to answer the question, the mystery of the ages. But it was an interesting and affectionate look at the individuals who had attempted to answer that question, to use scientific method.
Then the role with highly praised works, you jumped into sex with Boeing, the curious coupling of science and sex. Tell us about your transition from spirit to body with this book.
Well, it was kind of an abrupt change of direction. It didn't follow any natural segue, but that was a book that came about simply from reading one sentence in an article. And I just knew that this would be the next book. I was reading Film Quarterly, and I don't know what the circumstances were. I don't subscribe to Film Quarterly, but I happened to be looking at an issue of Film Quarterly that mentioned the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson, the sex researchers Masters and Johnson. I knew that colposcopy had to do with taking a, biopsying the cervix or something like that. So it sounded to me like these were films made inside a woman's body, that they were trying to study this by actually documenting it. And as it turned out, that's exactly what they had done. They'd built a sort of penis camera with a miniaturized light source, and they were using this to document sexual arousal on the inside. And I remember just thinking, this is really rich, awkward, amazing, material. And so that sex research, you know, the study of sexual physiology specifically, that was the third book.
And you and in your research for this book, you and your husband became personally part of a project that Dr. Jing Zhang was involved in. Can you tell us about that a big net?
Yes. Well, the challenge with that book was I wanted to get at the very awkward and singular experience of being a subject in a sexual physiology study, and specifically, you know, actually having sex. I mean, there are different. I mean, there's some of the more current work involves some, you know, an fMRI, like scanning someone's brain while they masturbate or something, which is like one person and their finger. But the early work, Masters and Johnson, actually had couples come in, and I was interested in that, and I found this Dr. Jing Deng, who was working on a diagnostic technique involving three-dimensional ultrasound imaging, and he had wanted to. And I came across a paper of his, a legitimate paper, on this technique, and in it he mentioned that he would be interested in documenting actual intercourse. And I wrote to him saying, "Well, I'd like to be there when you do this." And he wrote back that he hadn't been able to find a brave couple for intimate study, but that if my organization wanted to provide one, he would arrange it. So, and this was at London Hospital, and so my organization called its husband, and my husband was brave enough or foolhardy enough to say yes, and so off we went to London, and it was certainly the most awkward reporting trip I've ever been on, but I knew it would be very fun to write up because, you know, it's never the pleasant experiences that make for good scenes. It's usually the ones that are in some way horrible, awkward, embarrassing.
Did they go out of their way, though, to make you as comfortable as possible, did you think?
Yes, absolutely. If you're going to have sex in front of a researcher, I would recommend Dr. Dang. He was very, very matter-of-fact. He had his lab coat, and, you know, we had little hospital johnnies we were wearing, and he was, you know, at the controls of the machine, and it felt like a strange medical procedure rather than sex. It was, you know, as sex goes, terrible. It was awkward and very, very odd, but again, entertaining to read about.
Then 2 years after recovering from that experience, you're off to outer space, but packing for Mars, the Curious Science of Life in the Void. What piqued your interest in space after being concerned with very earthbound personal states of humans?
Yes, this book I got interested in when I got back in touch with somebody I'd known from a magazine story, and he was working at the bed rest facility near NASA, Johnson Space Center, and this is a place where people are paid upwards of $15,000 to lie in bed for 3 months without getting up, without sitting up, and what they're doing is simulating, it's an analog, they're simulating zero gravity, the effects of it. In other words, if you don't use your bones and muscles for that period of time, they start to disintegrate, you lose bone and your muscles atrophy, and this is a problem for astronauts. So there was this very sort of bizarre kind of almost like debtor's prison where people would go and like did $17,000. They knew they couldn't spend money while they were there. They had to lay in bed. They couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom. They had to use a bedpan. So it's a very strange and interesting world there. So that combined with two other Johnson Space Center experiences that led me to believe that space, the experience of space, a lot of the stuff that went on the ground was as interesting as what the astronauts' memoirs were about, you know, from actual being in space.
How much confidence in our ability to conquer all of the impediments to reaching other planets after your research for this book?
I'm sorry, what was the beginning of the question?
How much confidence do you have in our ability to conquer all of the impediments to reaching other planets?
Well, it's pretty tough for Mars because it's so much farther, and you, the astronaut, that is, will be exposed to so much radiation traveling there, solar radiation and cosmic radiation, because it's so much, now we're talking years, not days for a moon mission. So that's, you know, that's worrisome. And they talk about, they being NASA, talk about sending someone in their 60s. So the radiation, if you do get a mutation, by the time the cancer appears, say 10 years later, they will have lived a full life, and you know, they will have had children. They will have, you know, done those milestones that most people would want to do. And so, you know, that's a serious, consideration. It's quite a risk. Not to mention just, you know, is this going to be a one-way mission, or are we talking about just being resupplied and living out the rest of your life on Mars, which is what some of the programs are talking about? And, you know, it's kind of extreme immigration. You're immigrating to Mars. I think that, you know, NASA will probably never undertake something that seems as grim as that, but there are plenty of astronauts who would do it in a heartbeat. But I think the bone loss and the muscle wasting, there's ways to deal with that. The psychological issues, I think, if you choose you have to be very careful who you choose and how you put together a crew. Probably the, you know, radiation and just the dangers of, you know, will you be able to get back up off the surface of Mars? You know, that those are the two main problems. But I think it could be done. I don't want to do it.
Would sending people in their 60s, though, and then they have this long trip, would they be able, no matter if they were affected by the radiation or not, be robust enough to handle whatever physical things that they'd have to do at Mars in their 70s?
I think you would have to definitely choose robust individuals at 60. There's some pretty fit 60-year-olds out there.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Exactly. Yeah.
3 years later, you were back to an examination of something we all do, eat, with Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. Tell us both about that work and how you got interested in it.
Gulp is a really nose to tail. It's the tube, you know, the story of this very strange long tube that goes down the middle of all of us. And I felt as though there was so much being written and photographed in the realm of cooking and food. But once it's inside the mouth, nobody wants to think about it. Once it's been chewed, of course, everyone's revolted and nobody thinks about it. But there's a lot of fairly miraculous things happen along that journey. And I kind of like the idea of, like, on the alimentary canal. It kind of gave the idea of this being a travel book. You know, it would take people kind of along the canal and point out interesting things along the way. Of course, like all of my books, there's some, you know, the kind of esoteric aspects of the journey. But it was just I think because I work with a couple of food writers, and there's just endless amounts of blogging and writing about the things that we eat, but never about the kind of miraculous stuff that goes on past the mouth.
You mentioned the esoteric aspect to your writing. Your writing has been praised along the way, both for the humor that you bring to science and the interesting aspects. Had you planned in the very beginning to inject humor into your original books?
I never planned it, but it was always the most fun for me, and whenever I could get away with it, that is to say, whenever the topic allowed it, I would do it because it was satisfying and fun. And if it's fun to write, I think it tends to be fun for people to read. So it seemed to work out well. But yeah, that's not to say that everything I write is funny. But it wasn't a goal. It just is how I write. And I think I've recently, you know, been going through my file cabinet and throwing things out, and some of the pieces that I first wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle Sunday magazine, the tone, the style is very similar. It really has not something that I developed over time. I think I've become a little more discerning and a little better at taking out the things that maybe don't work or seem to be trying too hard. But the voice was there kind of from the beginning.
The same year as Gulp, you published My Planet, Finding Humor in the Artist Places, sticking with talking about humor, the collection of your Reader's Digest, My Planet columns. Tell us about your writing for the Digest.
Yeah, that was a very fun column for me. It's really just slices of life. It's often the humor is the lines that my husband Ed says, or the dynamic between him and me. He's we're kind of an opposites attract scenario. He's very tidy and clean, and I'm kind of a slob, and he's neurotic and I'm carefree, and he's neurotic in a good way and I'm carefree sometimes in a overly cavalier way. So it just, there's a lot of humor that comes from that kind of a couple's kind of butting heads over things. So it's just sort of modern life and whatever struck my fancy. There was just a short column, maybe 700 words, and I did it for maybe two, three years. And it was a lot of fun, and Reader's Digest owned the rights to it. And years later, I wrote them long before my first book came out, but they, because they owned the rights, got the idea much later on to put out a collection. So I wasn't really involved in the design or the cover or any of that. It was just the material. I had written the material, but they owned the rights. So anyway, it's fine. They're columns that the writing is slightly different from my other books, but I'm very fond of that column. They were just a tremendous amount of fun to write.
So because they owned the rights, that's why it was published by Penguin rather than your normal publisher then.
I think it's Reader's Digest published it, didn't they? Or is it Penguin?
It says Penguin. Perhaps they have a deal with them.
Yeah. They probably do. Yeah, it was not through W.W. Norton, who has published all my other books. Yeah, it was a different publisher, yep.
And that brings us to now, 2016. You have this great new book, Grunt, that begins with the Monty Python-like story of the Air Force, having chicken shot out of artillery pieces at planes.
Chicken gun, yes.
And goes on to touch such subject as penis transplants, soldiers wounded, and how diarrhea can be a threat to national security. How in the world did you get wind of such topics, and how did you get the military to discuss them with you? They all sound so wacky.
Yeah, the idea came from actually the Indian Defense Ministry. I was reporting a story in India on the hottest chili pepper in the world, and while I was reporting that, I learned that this chili pepper, the Bhuta Cholokia, had been turned into a kind of a tear gas, only more of a tear powder. It had been weaponized by the Indian Defense Ministry, and I thought that was interesting. So I went over to this lab where this had happened, and I interviewed people. And while I was there, they were showing me around. They were working on a leech repellent, which is, that's the kind of thing. A leech repellent, I don't know. That's kind of Monty Python meets science and meets Mary Roach. So I had this notion that maybe military science was more just broader and more esoteric, more eclectic than one might think, and that that side of combat had not really been covered in a book. There's so many books about the high drama of combat and actual weapons and fighting and that sort of thing, the stuff of movies, and there were all this, a lot of work that goes on in the realm of keeping people alive, soldiers that is, rather than killing. And I thought that it would be a fun thing to explore, and it took me to a lot of different places, and you do a lot of just sort of poking around and digging and find things like a military entomology department. I never had heard of military entomology as a discipline. So that kind of thing where you just stumble onto all these kind of fabulously eclectic things. And you asked about access, and the military was surprisingly straightforward and helpful, because these were things, you know, these are all good stories to tell. They're typically things that make the experience of war a little less awful or a little safer. So there's not really much, there wasn't much reason for them to be trying to hide it from me. I think, if anything, I thought that my tone and my style in my previous books might be an impediment, but I was always careful to send people copies of my previous books so that they knew what I did, and it didn't seem to faze them. They were pretty helpful. I mean, sometimes it's finding the right individual. You know, asking. I do a lot of asking around and emailing around and trying to find some. You know, if someone doesn't answer or says no, I move on to someone else. Or, yeah, you know, persistence is a great boon to the job that I do. Just not giving up, but pushing on. And when people say no, very often it's just a kind of a fear of the unknown. You know, and if you can explain what you're doing and reassure them and put them in touch with other people from other books, and you know, they usually, there's no reason for them to say no.
Didn't the Air Force realize that the SPCA would be all over them for firing the chickens?
Well, they're supermarket chickens that have been frozen and thawed, so they're already dead.
They're already, yeah. However, it's still a something that I think that real pet lovers to go, ah, ah. Did the research that you did for the book cause you to have a totally different view of the military than you had before? And if so, is it more positive or more negative than it was?
Well, I ended up with a more nuanced view of the military, in that I used to have just sort of a view of the military as this monolithic entity. And when you spend a couple of years, you realize how vast it is and how different the characteristics and sort of types of people that you encounter. I mean, there's the different branches of the military. There's the enlistees and the people who are deployed. There's the medical and the research scientists. There's the bureaucrats. There's the Pentagon. And they're all, so there's a lot of shades of gray to it. So I think that it made it a little more difficult to have kind of a overall sense of the military. The people that I dealt with were almost across the board really intelligent and caring people who were really serious about the work they were doing and the importance of it. So that, I was a big fan of those folks. You know, I'm not a big fan of war.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that's all.
After your experience, then you probably don't believe that Donald Trump knows more about the Iraq conflict than our generals, I guess. So I think that's
one of I don't think Donald Trump knows more. No, I don't think so.
That's one of the more bizarre statements of this campaign. It was I didn't realize that your father had come over on the Lusitania. In today's New York Times article, you mentioned that you were staying up late of going down on the Lusitania. Did your family history with you point you in the directions of books on the Lusitania?
Yes. But also, I'm very fond of the writing of Eric Larson. You know, his books are, you know, I've read a couple of his books before this one, Dead Wake. So it was the combination of the Lusitania and the fact that it was Eric Larson made it hard to resist. And it was, he has this wonderful way of these two narratives coming closer and closer. In this case, you know, the U-boat and the Lusitania. And, you know, the captains of both of those he profiles. And, you know, it's just a good yarn. Unfortunately, there's not anything in the book about steerage class, which is how my father came over. And the reason for that is there's just not with the poorer classes of people, there's not memoirs and biographies, and there's not really documentation, I think, of those people's stories. I had been hoping for a bit of a glimpse of what it had been like in steerage class on the Lusitania, but nonetheless, a really fascinating book.
The courage of some of these people. I had four grandparents born in Ireland, and the way they got on these coffin ships, as they were called, and just leaving where they had spent all of their lives to that point, and sailing across the ocean where many of them died on board and to a new land showed tremendous courage. I'm not sure that I'd have that courage now, but it's
and leaving folks behind knowing that there was a very good chance they'd never see them again. You started over. I mean, my father, when you asked him about his past, it started in New York when he got here. He wouldn't really talk about it. His childhood and his family and his life in England as a child, he just wouldn't talk about it. And I don't know if it was because he'd remade himself as Protestant upper middle class Church of England and he was ashamed of his past, or if it was too sad for him to talk about the people he'd left behind and never got to see again.
How old was he when he came over?
19.
Okay.
Yeah.
That same interview points me in the direction of dissent. I hadn't looked at that yet. I read about at least four books a month.
Yeah.
This is his first novel, and it made you miss your airplane, huh?
It's an amazing. He's a beautiful literary writer. You know, it's a page turner. It's a thriller, but it's almost writing as beautiful as, you know, Cormac McCarthy or someone in that vein. Yet it's this taut kind of emotional, amazing page turner. Which is an unusual combination. I think a book that you can't put down, but that is also unbelievably beautifully written. I had read a book of his short stories some years ago, and really liked them, and then saw that he had the novel, and it's so good. It did well, but it was one of those books I just feel like it should have been a huge best. I mean, it did. I think it made the bestseller list, but I wanted it to be as big a seller as like The Lovely Bones, or you know, every now and then a novel just gets sort of plucked out of the fray and thrown to the top of all the lists, and I really wanted that book to. I felt that it deserved that. It did well, though. It just, anyway, very good. I recommend it. Yes, and I did. I missed my flight.
I'll add to the purchases of the book. You also mentioned one of my favorite books of all time, All the King's Men.
Yes.
I read that in, it must have been in high school, and it still ranks with that. And Robert Penn Warren's so interesting. He's one of the few writers that have been recognized both as a very accomplished novelist and a very accomplished poet. There are some people that write both, but the poetry is kind of an afterthought, or the novels aren't the class of the poetry, but not with him.
Yes, and when you read All the King's Men, it's so clear he's a poet. He, you know, it's like Mary Carr, the poet and novelist who wrote The Liars Club.
Right.
Just the writing is so beautiful and so poetic. Robert Penn Warren is the same way. Sentence by sentence, just you can't believe how he put those words together. He's such a gifted writer, and you really see the poetry in his novel.
What's next for you after you get beyond promoting the book? What's your next plan?
I don't know exactly what I'll do. I mean, I will hopefully, I plan to do another book, or more than one book, but I'm not sure. I'm mulling a bunch of things that are all quite larval, and I'm not really sure where I'm going with them or if I'm going with them. So I may do some magazine writing in the meantime, writing for Smithsonian, National Geographic. Those are a couple of places that I enjoy writing for. It's kind of fun to do a shorter format for a little while, just to kind of catch your breath and mull things over until you step into the next big project.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Mary Roach?
I don't know. I think they know pretty much everything now. They know as much as I do.
Well, other than to run out to buy the books, right?
Well, so, yes. Yeah. That's always nice when people want to do that. No
that
pressure.
That Seattle thing looks very interesting. It looks like you're giving the book and two admissions for the price of one. I think that's
I like that format. That's not something that I initiated. That's what the organizers set up. But I've been to Town Hall a couple times before, and it's one of my favorite stops on any book tour. It's a wonderful venue, and the energy of the audience is always stupendous. So I look forward to it.
Well, thank you very much, Mary. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed it.
Just a bit of commercial information. My column now appears bi-weekly in Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format as well as online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and blogger.com. Send any comments to the show to me, please, at johnmuck13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, and we'll be back again next week, and I hope you'll join us for my conversation with Alan Brody. Until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silva. Whoa, whoa, whoa. To William Tell, please. And it's not coming up, so I'll just say good night, everybody. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Mary. So.